I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Christopher Wray, the director of the FBI, told the House Homeland Security Committee yesterday that Russia is meddling in the 2020 presidential election.
We certainly have seen very active efforts by the Russians to influence our election in 2020 through what I would call more the malign foreign influence side of things. Social media, use of proxies, state media, online journals, et cetera, an effort to both sow divisiveness and discord, and I think the intelligence community has assessed this publicly, to denigrate Vice President Biden and what the Russians see as kind of an anti-Russian establishment. That's essentially what we're seeing in 2020.
It seems that disinformation and conspiracy theories about the election and voting, about the coronavirus pandemic, even the cause of the wildfires out west are everywhere, especially online. And if you feel as if you're losing track of what's true and what's false, you're not alone. It's confusing out there. So today in Radio Times, why is there so much disinformation online, including deep fakes, cheap fakes, conspiracies, and hoaxes? Who is spreading it, and why do so many people believe it? Also, how serious a threat are conspiracy theories like QAnon to our democracy, and how can we fight back? Joining us by Skype is Clint Watts. He's Distinguished Research Fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, which is in Philadelphia. He's a non-resident fellow at the Alliance for Securing Democracy, also a national security contributor to NBC News and MSNBC, wrote a book called Messing with the Enemy. He's also a former FBI special agent. Clint Watts, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. Also with us is Brendan Nyhan, and he's a professor of government at Dartmouth College, co-founder of Bright Line Watch. It's a watchdog group that monitors the status of American democracy. Brendan Nyhan, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Nice to have you both with us. Let me begin with you, Clint, if I could. Are we better prepared today to address and debunk the disinformation propaganda of this year's election than we were in 2016? Did we learn anything in the last 4 years?
I think we definitely learned, and I think we're definitely better with regards to foreign manipulation and interference. However, I think the negative countercurrent to all of this is how widespread domestic disinformation and misinformation is today, particularly with regards to the election. And that is really the bigger fear. I like to say that, you know, in 2016, the Russians used a lot of fake news, manipulated news to dupe Americans. And today, they don't have to do that. For the most part, they can grab a narrative from the White House, a political party, activist groups, and use that to sow chaos inside the U.S. audience space and amplify. Today, Russia doesn't write fake news. They just take fake news from American audiences and really sends it right back into U.S. audience spaces. On the defensive side, I think you've seen some really good progress, whether it's the U.S. government specifically doing outing from the State Department of different Russian outlets. You're hearing Director Wray yesterday, who it seems was involved in helping take down some of those nefarious news outlets just a couple weeks back. You saw where Microsoft announced the defense and essentially reported what seemed like a couple hundred hacking attempts stemming from Russia, some from China as well. And so across the board, it's pretty remarkable. And you've got the social media companies doing takedowns. I think the big gap this time is what's going on inside America, not so much what's coming in to America from the outside.
Well, Brendan, what's happening inside America is we've got a pandemic, we've got protests, we have a very partisan election season. We've got, it seems to me, a lot of things that are just going on that people are experiencing. Also, the economic anxiety from the pandemic, that all of that has created a lot of mistrust, anxiety, even paranoia. Does that feed the kind of conspiracy theories that could undo an election?
Well, potentially. There definitely are studies that suggest that when people feel a lack of control, they may be more vulnerable to conspiracy theories. I think the jury's still out on that line of research, but it's a plausible claim. And you can certainly imagine how it might apply right now. People's lives are have literally been upended. There's a dangerous pandemic raging. Those are the kinds of circumstances when and, you know, the economy's been hurt, and those are the kinds of circumstances when people might be looking for simple explanations or enemies to blame. And online conspiracy theories are happy to try to fill that void. I do think it's a dangerous context, but I do think we should be clear in distinguishing the magnitude of the threat coming from these different sources. The Russian interference is worrisome, but really represented a tiny fraction of the news that people saw in 2016. The QAnon theory, which we can talk about, is sure, worrisome, but it's a very fringe belief. When you're talking about the threats to the legitimacy of the election, those are coming primarily from the president of the United States, who has a larger media platform than all of the bots and trolls put together times a thousand. He's the most covered man in the world, and he's directly attacking the legitimacy of the election, promoting conspiracy theories about how it will be stolen or rigged. And, you know, that's a problem of our domestic politics. That's not something about the platforms or bots or trolls or Russians. And we have to take that on directly and consider how to address that and not externalize these threats to these you know, other sources, which are worrisome but much smaller in magnitude.
Well, you both have mentioned the president, and we know from the Washington Post they have been tracking his thousands at this point, numbers of false statements. He certainly has retweeted conspiracy theories. He was one of the original and most outspoken birthers when it came to candidate and then President Obama's birth certificate. Going back to you, Clint Watts, then, and he does have, you know, the largest megaphone in the world. How does a country or even a people then address conspiracy theories coming from the most powerful man in the world?
I think there's only one true remedy, and that's political leadership across the board and bipartisanship. The most troubling part to me, I think, just over the last year has been that politicians will continue to let him say that, even politicians that are aligned with the president, and will let him push these conspiracies and will not challenge him or refute him. And until they do, he's going to be seen as the voice, essentially, at least for 40%, it looks like. You know, pretty much every poll is 40%. 40% believe what the president says about mail-in ballots or about election rigging, and 40% support him regardless of the outcome of any given event. And so until that changes, you're going to have this highly divided America. It's really two Americas, one that's listening to one part of an information ecosystem, one that's listening to a different part of it. And I think the danger comes is, regardless of the outcome of the election, we're facing COVID-19, economic turmoil like we've never really seen, political instability, climate change, and add on that our foreign adversaries, authoritarian around the world sort of ganging up against us, Iran, China, Russia. How are we going to meet those challenges when we can't even amass a majority of Americans to have the same reality? I think that's the biggest danger of them all, is we really can't move forward as a country till we come together as a country.
Well, that raises a question. I'll go back to you, Brendan Eihan, about, you know, fact-checking organizations, and there are a bunch of them. They work really hard to make sure that their readers or the people that follow them are getting the correct information. But you've talked about a kind of backfire effect when it comes to fact checkers. And I even have to say sometimes on this show, if we play a clip that's not true in order to tell people it's not true, are we kind of feeding into the kind of false impression people have about the news or about a specific topic or piece of information?
Yeah, it's a difficult dilemma how to cover and respond to misinformation. I should say that the research since that initial study that my co-author and I published about the backfire effect, including in my own research, is that backfire effects are very rare. Most fact-checking does seem to help people have more accurate beliefs when they're shown it. The challenge, though, is that a lot of times false claims are reported without context or a fact-check or in a he said, she said manner that doesn't adequately clarify that they're false. And many other people simply never see the fact checks of the claims in question. In 2016, for instance, my co-authors and I found fewer than half of the people who visited untrustworthy websites in the period before the election went to a fact checking website at all. Right. So, you know, fact checks have to be part of the solution, but they can't be all of it. And even if they are a part of the solution, we need to think about how they work. Given that people aren't seeking out fact checks, what can we do? So one of the most important developments since 2016 has been the partnership between Facebook and third-party journalistic fact-checking partners who label stories on the website as false or misleading, and Facebook decreases their reach on the platform. It's not a perfect solution. We can talk about the challenges that it faces, but it does represent a significant improvement since 2016. Now people don't have to go find that fact check for themselves. Instead, mm-hmm. Facebook is deprioritizing that dubious content that people might otherwise see on Facebook. And it's being the judgment about the accuracy of the claim is being made by this third party fact checker, not on Facebook. So that's one encouraging development. The other way I think we should consider how fact checking can make political discourse better is by discouraging politicians from making false claims in the first place. You know, and this gets back to some of the political factors that Clint was talking about. Fact checking, there's some evidence, including from my own research, that fact checking can help to discourage politicians from making false claims. We need there to be severe reputational sanctions for making false claims, particularly in a context like now in the midst of a pandemic when the stakes are so high. Those should be career-ending gaffes, not the latest in a string of false claims that we ignore. And, you know, we need to think about how to make those sanctions more stringent and in that way discourage politicians from making these claims in the first place. Again, it's easy to localize the problem to Donald Trump, but what he's revealed is that our politics doesn't penalize politicians enough for being irresponsible. And I, of course, don't mean in a governmental sense. Within the First Amendment, these are matters of civil society and public debate, but our politics needs to be harsher. And we need to be harsher on people from our own side of the aisle who make false or unsupported claims, or this pattern is just going to continue.
Clint, we're almost up on a break here, but do you agree with what Brendan said? And what would be a harsh kind of punishment within the context of our democracy and free speech?
I think one is putting in timeouts. We really underestimate the importance of presence on platforms to reach audience. For example, if the president were to push out an erroneous claim on his Twitter account, which is the most powerful Twitter account in the world, social media account in the world, and was suddenly suspended for 2 weeks, that is a counter. I mean, that will resonate. It limits his ability to communicate. He sort of built his own information dissemination system. I think on the people level, it's when there's the one-to-one rebuttal that is caught in a mass media situation. The one I always kind of point back to is when Senator John McCain, there was some erroneous claims being made in front of him about Barack Obama, if you remember back. And sure. He stopped a woman in her tracks and said, "That is not true. You know, I have differences with him, but that is not true." That was incredibly powerful. So if you can do it online and in person, I think it can really work over time.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation, talking with Clint Watts and Brendan Nyhan about fact and fiction, what to do about both of them.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
With us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with our guests Clint Watts and Brendan Nyhan about how to tell fact from fiction, especially this election season with so much domestic and foreign propaganda and disinformation. We're talking about how to debunk things like conspiracy theories and hoaxes and why they're so believable to so many and why they are, frankly, a threat to democracy. Clint Watts is a distinguished research fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. Brendan Nyhan, Professor of Government at Dartmouth College, co-founder of Brightline Watch, which is a watchdog group that monitors the status of American democracy. And again, you can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Paul from Wildwood to join our conversation. And Paul, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
I just wanted to ask about Fox News. I heard you say that something like 40% of Americans believe every word that comes out of Trump's mouth. And I think I've heard that's the same percentage of people who tune into Fox News. It's the most, you know, watched and listened to network. And just curious what you'd have to say about that. Also about Chris Wallace, who seems like he kind of goes counter to their standard line sometimes.
All right. Well, let's talk about Fox News and I guess where people get their news and information. Clint, do you have any thoughts from Paul's comment?
Yeah, I think when you go back through a lot of war propaganda studies and you look at the principles, you know, World War II and even earlier, there's tendencies to believe certain things. That which you see the first, that which you see the most, that which isn't accompanied by a rebuttal, and that which comes from a trusted source. And so if you look at the way from television in the 80s and 90s to cable television to then radio and now to social media, you see this partitioning of American society into information bubbles where you get confirmation bias, you get implicit bias because you seek out information from people that look like you and talk like you, and then you get status quo bias, which comes in from tribalism, which is you don't want to go against the crowd because you want to stay, you know, in your tribe, and you tend to go along with it. So that's a great point with Chris Wallace, right? Like, you can see how powerful he is really as a spokesperson for the media because he does rebut on a channel that generally does not. And Fox News is unique in its support of the president and how they pursued it. But all channels, you know, nowadays tend to have a bias, and that's due to market effects. That's due to the audience that's there and some of the challenges. And I think what's been interesting in the social media space is how we tend to ignore. We blame it on the companies and we blame it on the algorithms. And yes, they are responsible to a degree. But ultimately, we should also look at ourselves and our preferences. Hmm. We choose information. It is a like button for a reason. Social media is designed to deliver you information that you like from people that look like you and talk like you, your friends and family, your coworkers, your cable news network that you pick. You probably chose it because of your own personal beliefs and because it tells you things that you like to hear, the types of stories you want, and the viewpoint. So if you don't get a balanced information diet, then you will be in a bubble. And the question is, do you want to be in your bubble or do you want to be out of your bubble? And I think for a democracy to work, we have to have that social capital, which transcends those bubbles. And that's really where I'm worried about for our information environment over time. This goes even to your apps now on television, you know, in your streaming services, right? It's an algorithm that delivers you more of what they think you would want to watch or like. You can really descend yourself into an alternative reality over time.
Well, let me go back and pick up on that. And Brendan, I'll go back to you. And there's this thing that we, I think, are more familiar now, which is confirmation bias, is that we seek out the information that tells us that we are right in our belief system. So if the idea is to try to figure out how to find this consensus and people are seeking out their own, quote unquote, truths, how do we break down some of those barriers so that we're willing to say to ourselves, you know, I was wrong about that. I thought it was X and it's actually Y. I mean, it seems to me that takes a big kind of courageous psychological step.
Absolutely. It's hard to admit that we're wrong, and that applies sure. to all of us. And I guess I would say, though, that I think this problem is less about information diets as such and more about the predispositions that people have. Mm-hmm. It's true that Fox plays an outsized role in the conservative media ecosystem. It's also true that the overwhelming majority of Americans actually don't watch Fox every day. You know, Fox was the most popular network in August, but it was averaging around 3.5 million viewers a night. So there's more than 300 million Americans. That means the overwhelming majority of them are not watching Fox. You know, we can't blame this problem on Fox alone. It plays an important role, again, among conservatives. But what the behavioral data has shown is that most people actually don't have relatively slanted information diets. The information sources they consume tend to be more balanced, and a lot of people don't actually pay very close attention to political news at all. So what's the problem? We need to be more specific about the problem. Well, there's a subset of people who consume a lot of political news, and they tend to have more slanted information diets. Those people often tend to be the most vocal and visible, and they tend to be the most politically influential because they're activated and because they're closely aligned with one, more likely to be closely aligned with one party. So those people play an outsized role. There's a lot of other people who don't pay very close attention or who tend to go with their side when it comes to political matters, but aren't following it very closely. And so I think the question sometimes is, when will the real world challenge people's beliefs and cause them to say, well, maybe I was wrong? And for some time, I've been relatively optimistic about the everyday experience having that effect. So when the economy is bad, it's hard for people to deny. And we see that in polling. But we're currently living through a pandemic that is falsifying the misinformation that people are being given on a daily basis. And nearly 200,000 Americans have died. And yet we're still struggling, even as our lives have been upended by this pandemic, to break through misinformation about the dangers of COVID-19 and the novel coronavirus, which is pretty staggering to me. So that, I mean, that suggests just how difficult the problem is right now.
And just sort of
getting
how
people to change their minds and to move off their default partisan assumptions is really hard.
Is really hard. Let me mention QAnon, and I'll go back to you, Clint Watts. And again, you don't want to give, as Brendan Nyhan was saying, you don't want to give some of these fringe groups too much attention. But nonetheless, there are some elected or some people who want to serve in the U.S. government who apparently have signed on to some of their beliefs. How do you see QAnon and their belief system, such as it is absolutely preposterous? It seems very dangerous, especially during a pandemic and times of such political division and mistrust. How do you see QAnon and what should be done about it, if anything?
QAnon is fascinating because it's not that dissimilar from other belief systems, you know, that you might see out there. And the idea 2 years ago was preposterous, but you can tell how it's grown in terms of what people believe and how it's slipped into the mainstream discussion, right? We've seen interviews with people who are wearing QAnon patches, you know, that are working in law enforcement. We've seen QAnon mugs, I mean, merchandise, those sorts of things. And so what I find fascinating about it is the amalgamation of a lot of different interests. Some people were just trying to sell things, I think, in the beginning, and it became a way to do that. Other people identified it as a way to mobilize people for political purposes around initially really the Russia investigation, but how that's expanded to the Trump campaign, you know, headed into the election. What I always am concerned about with these movements is the extreme, the people that take it to such an extreme that actually believe it and then decide the only way to advance the cause of this belief system is through violence. And that's where it gets quite frightening. It's not that dissimilar from domestic or international terrorist groups and movements that we've seen. We saw this, you know, after 2016 election with Pizzagate, where luckily one man with one weapon, you know, showed up at a pizza joint in D.C. based on one of these conspiracies. But now you've started to see over time now, 3 years, probably 6-7 different very serious incidents based on these fantasies, you know, that are built up by Q. If you went into the QAnon community, you would find a lot of people just doing it, I think, even out of entertainment purposes, right? You'll see other people do it. Maybe they don't believe it, but they like the camaraderie of it. So it's more about the social network. Others are there because they see it as a political mobilization tool and a powerful one that they can use in a very specific way. And if you look at General Flynn and the, you know, sort of the kerfuffle around him doing the oath around July 4th, that was like, wow, is this a mobilization movement to disrupt our American democracy? What I think is quite problematic is the mobilization aspect. Since the pandemic kicked off, whether it's been allegations of Antifa mobilizing on buses or airplanes and coming to your town, we've seen these sort of vigilante groups spout up. You've seen connections with those with QAnon and then connections with those with other extremist groups. And so I think my big concern is at what point does that iceberg keep floating? The more people that are supporting the ideas subsurface and on social media, the more the 10% to 1% that sticks up above the water of that iceberg maybe believe the conspiracy and want to mobilize to do something under false pretenses. And I think that's why I get concerned when I see this, the scope, size, and scale of this movement keep growing over time.
Brendan, do you share some of Clint's concern about QAnon?
I do. I think it's important to be specific about the risk that QAnon poses.
as I was underscoring, you know, most people don't believe it. Only a majority of Americans just recently learned what it was, according to public opinion polling.
Yeah. Pew Research.
At the same time, there's two really specific risks that it poses. The first is that it inspires direct real-world harms. It encourages people to take action, sometimes violent, in the way that Clint's describing. That's why QAnon's been identified as a potential threat. The second is that QAnon has begun to gain a foothold in the base of the Republican Party in a way that's dangerous. We depend on our political parties to keep out dangerous fringe and extremist groups. We're now going to have almost certainly the first QAnon-supporting member of Congress in the next after this election, a woman in Georgia who has won the Republican nomination in a very safe seat and has said all sorts of outlandish Q-supporting things in the past. So that's a worrisome trend, especially when many people are refusing to denounce her and QAnon beliefs, and sometimes even saying things that appeal to those QAnon supporters, posting messages online that QAnon supporters interpret as kind of coded signals of support. I think people are really playing with fire here. This is a dangerous fringe movement that could inspire violence, and it has no place in our politics.
I'm looking at a brand new Pew Research Center poll finding that roughly half of U.S. adults have heard of the conspiracy theories called QAnon, and then they dig a little deeper. About 4 in 10 Republicans who have heard the QAnon conspiracy theories say that QAnon is a good thing for the country. Just to underscore what you just, what both of you have said, let me get David from Fairmount to join our conversation. And David, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Yes, Marty, earlier one of your guests seemed to be a little dismissive of the influence of QAnon and Republican trolling as a percentage of how much disinformation is out there. But would your guests acknowledge that, in my mind, that kind of disinformation is almost like a nerve agent, where one drop has such widespread devastating effect? And speaking anecdotally, I know so many people that believe the Pizzagate conspiracy, or it sowed enough doubt in them that it influenced their vote. And my second question, point I'd like them to address is, when we talk about pushback in leadership, like from the presidential level, to dismiss and to combat disinformation, Congress has a responsibility also, and I'm disturbed that the Republican Congress never pushes back against these disinformation. And here's a perfect example. Just last week, in the most salacious retweet of all, the president retweeted that Biden might be a pedophile, and there was no pushback from Republicans in Congress on that. So could your guest address the role that Congress has as well?
Sure. And I appreciate the call to Radio Times, David. And I think both of them did in their own kind of way. But do you want to speak to that, Clint? And he also raises this question about doubt, that disinformation kind of sows doubt so that you begin to doubt what is true, or maybe even your own beliefs about what is true. Can you speak to that as well?
Yeah. In terms of Congress, it is the weakest link in America institutionally, in my mind. Right now, I mean, just personally, I think I've testified 5 or 6 times regarding disinformation, misinformation, deep fakes, those sorts of things. And really nothing has ever come of any of that. You know, almost no legislation has been passed. There's been some authorizations for the government. At least it's bubbled to the top of discussions, but very little has been done. I believe it was Ben Sasse of Nebraska, Senator Sasse, you know, did challenge on the QAnon issue. And so, but he's been about the only one. And until there's some pushback, even if it's not politically advantageous, and there's some pushback to this, it will go unabated. I think to the larger extent of how it sows doubt, this is why you see, I'm going to use the social media context first and bring it back into the mainstream. This is why you see bots, computational propaganda on social media. The idea is to distort the volume of what people see. If people don't see it at all, it's impossible for them to even consider it. So that's why it's so powerful when you have a person with outsized influence bring up a topic or bring up a piece of disinformation, that it begins to work, because people then have to question the validity of that statement. And before that, they had never considered it. the more they see it, the more they'll have to question it. And this is very much part of the Russian disinformation system, which is just the firehood of falsehoods and pushing just constant conspiracies, is it wears the person out to where they can't evaluate what reality is anymore. We are now doing this to ourselves. The Russians aren't doing this to us. We're doing it to ourselves. But this shows the power of key influencers, whether they're online or in person, and particularly elected officials, is that they can bring this. Imagine if a QAnon believer wins a congressional seat, and now they are at a committee asking me or another witness, right, about a QAnon conspiracy or a government official. Just asking the question gives it some validity, even if it's refuted. And you're having government officials and institutions wasting time chasing and refuting conspiracies that have no validity.
Brendan, about a minute before our second break here, but I want to make sure that listeners have tools so that they know if they see something online, what to look for that might tell them this is bogus, this is propaganda, this is fake.
Yeah, that's tough. I mean, if you don't see one of those Facebook labels, you're kind of on your own. You can certainly do some more due diligence to check. But I guess the first thing is just to think about whether that claim is likely to be accurate. Research shows that even just thinking about the accuracy of a claim before or a headline before engaging with it can play a really critical role in helping people to make better distinctions between true and false information. So just taking a breath, taking a second to think, is this really likely to be accurate? And if you're not sure, just not sharing it. And if it turns out something you did share is false, to delete that post, or remove it from your feed. And if someone else in your network did the same, to let them know in a friendly, respectful way that something they shared might be false. And in that way, actually, people can play an important role, that everyone's an influencer in their own social network. And sometimes just that little nudge to think yourself about whether something's accurate or to encourage a friend to do so can be quite powerful.
And that's Brendan Nyhan, who joins us along with Clint Watts. We're talking about disinformation, misinformation, conspiracy theories, and hoaxes. You can join us 1-888-477-9499. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this very short break.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. If you're just joining us, talking with our guests about how to tell fact from fiction, especially this election season with so much domestic and foreign propaganda and disinformation, Brendan Nyhan is a professor of government at Dartmouth College, co-founder of Bright Line Watch. That's a watchdog group that monitors the status of American democracy. Clint Watts is a distinguished research fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. He's a non-resident fellow at the Alliance for Securing Democracy. He's a national security contributor for NBC News and MSNBC, wrote a book called Messing with the Enemy, and he's a former FBI special agent. We got a lot of comments here. I do want to read some and then just get some responses from you. And I do want to also talk about sort of what's ahead in the next couple of weeks as we head towards the election, and then, of course, that period after the election and inauguration. But here's Robert from Conshohocken. He says, the Center for Voter Information sent him something asking for ballot information. He sent it back to a post office box address without thinking. He's worried that it was a disinformation campaign because he got another similar piece of mail from Montgomery County, and he goes on from there, just sort of worried about what he had done. Thomas says, I'm worried that we now live in a society that seems to be open to limiting speech to protect us from foreign influence and misinformation. This used to be a hallmark of authoritarian regimes, but now it seems to have come home. A comment from Stu, the authoritarian does not need you to believe that what he says is true. He just wants you to believe that nothing is true. A tweet from Janet, when TV began, the federal government required each channel to provide non-commercial news and had authority to revoke or suspend if news promoted lies. Could this help if renewed? Brendan, let me go back to you. Just picking up anything of those comments you want to comment on yourself?
Sure. The first thing is for the first listener who is asking about their ballot, I would just encourage them to contact their local election officials directly to make sure that they have access to the ballot this November, or to visit vote.org for more information on how to vote in their jurisdiction. These larger questions about undermining people's trust and what to believe, I do think are important. And this goes back to something Clint said that I think it's worth underscoring. People often think that the key to misinformation is convincing people that the claims are true. But in the countries that have seen significant democratic erosion around the world, it seems that people don't take government propaganda as literal truth. There may be a subset of people who do, but most people don't. It's that instead, as people have suggested, that people don't know what to believe. And we have to fight against that. And we have to fight against it on two fronts. We have to help people get better at identifying false information, but we also have to protect the legitimacy of credible information. I just want to underscore that point. Credible, legitimate forms of information are essential to the flourishing of human society. We need people we can trust to tell us how to protect ourselves against COVID-19, or to find out how to vote, or to find out who won the presidential election. And if we undermine trust in those sources, that's as damaging or even more damaging than the misinformation itself. So there's a real balancing act that we have to strike here.
Indeed. Let me pick up on something you just said. I'll toss this to you, Clint Watts, looking at the post-election, which is, you know, just 2 months away. It's pretty clear just the way voting is going to go that we're not going to know the results on election night when that normally happens, that there could be days, maybe even weeks before we know the results. Are you concerned that in that sort of time of confusion, or at least knowing who's going to be the next president of the United States, that we're just going to be filled with all sorts of disinformation and conspiracy theories to sort of undermine whatever the result is?
Yes. Marty, in 2016, despite all the Russian disinformation that was going on, and I was working on some research teams with that, on election night, I was mostly concerned about people mobilizing to polling places under false auspices that the ballots had been rigged or there was voter fraud. And that was minor compared to what we got this time around. I think when you look at election night this year, it is the conflation of everything. It is COVID-19. It is George Floyd protest. It is counter protest. It is climate change in certain areas and myths about climate change and how, fires were started. When you look at how this plays, you're seeing politicians using this to their advantage and essentially signaling statements like, you may need to take this into your own hands, or, you'll have to make sure that it's right. Or if I don't win, then it's definitely fraudulent, right? We're already seeing people mobilizing under false pretenses regarding Antifa, regarding conspiracies that they're getting on their cell phone via text messages. We are, panning through social media now, and we're seeing people talking about mobilizing today for election night in a few weeks. So that is what scares me the most. The other part that I think that is just hard to even model is what our world is like when we've been so separated physically from each other for the last 6 months. People tend to react, mobilize, engage in content when they're afraid, when they're angry, when it's political. And we have this, powder keg right now of those three things is going on. And a good way, Brendan brought the excellent point, people refute things in person, right, with their neighbors or with their family.
Sure.
We've never been more isolated than we've been in the last 7 months. People are spending more time on devices. It's been remarkable to watch parents talk about like surrendering to their kids playing video games oftentimes. So think about how isolated we are in the media, how it influences our perspective and understanding of the world. I've had people challenge me that the Biden conspiracy about pedophilia, which came up from one of your callers, and I had to push it down. That was from a friend. So this is what I'm really concerned about is the mobilization under false pretenses and whether politicians will play into that or not. I really think if there is a very clear winner on election night, things may be fine because these conspiracies won't unfold. But if there's a huge delay in the results, we don't really know. And then the politicians on either side play it up. That's where I'm going to be very nervous in November.
Brendan, do you worry about our democracy? Dan Coats, former director of the Director of National Intelligence, that was from 17 to 19, had a piece in the Washington Post. His concern about the future of our democracy with all the things that we've been talking about during the show today.
Very much. I'm very concerned. You know, you mentioned I'm one of the founders of Brightline Watch, this group that monitors the state of U.S. democracy. One of the things that we do is regularly poll experts about how they evaluate the quality of American democracy. And experts in our surveys, these are political scientists across the United States, very large numbers, rate U.S. democracy as worse now than it has been at any point in the Trump presidency and worse than it was prior to when Trump took office. That same decline in democratic quality is observed in other expert surveys, you know, and ratings of the United States. So there's a growing consensus that there's at least a downward trend in U.S. democracy generally, of which this misinformation is a part. And in that context, the misinformation about the election is incredibly worrisome. I worry this is a soft target for misinformation. It's hard to change people's minds about who to vote for. When you think about misinformation in the context of a general election, you have to remember that most people already know who they're going to vote for, or we can be very confident that Democrats will ultimately vote for a Democrat and Republicans will ultimately vote for a Republican. And there's not much you can tell people about Donald Trump or Joe Biden that's going to change their mind. The legitimacy of an election, though, that's not something that people are getting a lot of information about. It's assumed in the past to be legitimate, but people haven't been exposed to a lot of information that tries to undermine that confidence in those in that electoral process. And the counting of ballots in this country is a complicated, decentralized process. It's easy to muddy the waters. It's easy to create uncertainty. It's easy to convince people that the election is being stolen and that the vote is rigged. And that is very damaging. In countries that have seen significant democratic erosion, that's been one of the weak points. So I think we need to take those threats especially seriously and think very carefully about how we can reassure people, as Dan Coats says we must, Democrats and Republicans alike, that the election is not rigged, that there is not widespread voter electoral fraud, and that we will that people can have confidence in the process and the outcome, even if it doesn't turn out the way that they like. That's the linchpin of democracy itself, is a agreed upon process that determines the winner and that the loser accepts. We need to maintain that if we are to stay a democracy. So the stakes could not be higher right now.
And not just not to add to the kind of concern and anxiety people have, but Clint, let me just quote something that you wrote recently. You talk about the threat to democracy being the Electoral College. And we've had two elections in the last 20 years where the winner didn't get the popular vote. How much do you think the Electoral College undermines people's support and belief in our system of democracy and the system of voting, frankly?
Marty, it's interesting how it's played out. The Electoral College, to a degree, was invented to protect against foreign interference, you know, and its origination and why they were putting it together. And it was about somewhat to a degree elite control. But now when you look at it, it really makes it so that only roughly 10 states on any given election year matter. I know here in New York, you don't have to worry about many campaign ads, you know, at a presidential level. There isn't much going on. No one comes in campaigns here. They come for donations.
Sure.
But I think it's really adding to this idea of two Americas in the sense that when you look at the polarization in this country, you add in gerrymandering, how people vote. If half the time the loser wins, you know, the loser of the popular vote still wins the presidency, it adds a lot of fire to the legitimacy of democracy arguments that you even see from overseas. Vladimir Putin has specifically noted this before, that, you know, it's not a real democracy. They have the Electoral College, the loser wins. Why can you make fun of me as a foreign leader for always winning with 90% of the vote or whatever he gets, right, when your loser is the president? And so imagine, especially during this time where we've had a president who doesn't unite the country but continues to divide post-election, post-victory, and you're watching how COVID-19 aid is handed out, or the wildfires last week where the West Coast, you saw, you know, Governor Newsom speaking with the president, and it was two different worlds, and it was really antagonistic. Man, we used to talk about the second civil war, you know, with the QAnon sort of orbit and the Boogaloo movement. I think you will start to see on the other side, not civil war talk, but questions about why do we stay in this union if we are, you know, being disenfranchised as voters, if we're being, you know, essentially put under the tyranny of the minority vote getter. That could be very damaging, I believe, over time, and could really add to a general apathy, you know, about democracy.
Let me read a couple more comments, and hopefully I can squeeze a caller in. Deb says, I heard this recently, that a lie that affirms us carries more credence than a truth that challenges us. Trish says, isn't the bigger issue that Americans harbor fear-based beliefs that lead them to disbelieve true stories or believe fake stories? Veronica says, unbelievable. At 68 years of age, I feel like there is a horror movie playing out on the news every day. The amount of misinformation put out by Trump and this administration is horrifying, and I'm not being dramatic. Let me get Pat from Ridley to join our conversation. Pat, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to get you on the air. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hello?
Hi, go ahead, Pat. You're on the air, and the clock is ticking. You have about a minute. Go ahead.
Okay. My only thing is I picked up about halfway in, and I've been hearing about QAnon or whatever it is. Yep. And Antifa is riding through the streets, and Jerry Nadler said that it's a myth that the thing even exists. And as far as our credible sources, I believe we've heard for 3 years that Trump colluded with Russia, and when John Brennan and all those guys were under oath, they said they had no knowledge of it, so they lied for 3 years. If there's a problem with credible sources, I think the news media has done it to themselves.
Well, that's an interesting comment. Let me give our guests a chance to respond. I mean, it is interesting that, you know, Mueller came to the conclusion about Russia wanting to collude with the United States. The Senate Republican Committee came out with a report recently. The intelligence community talked about Russian interference, or certainly their involvement trying to bend the election towards now the president of the United States. Brendan, do you want to speak to that?
Sure. Well, you know, the details of both of the claims the caller raised are well beyond the time we have. But I would just say that it's certainly the case that there are false claims on both sides, even when asymmetry exists, and people shouldn't pretend otherwise. And I guess the challenge is, you know, when someone like the caller thinks about the misinformation from the other side and uses that to dismiss the misinformation from what might be their preferred side. And I think that's a temptation that lots of people have. And I would just encourage everybody to try to move past that. Like, even if it's true that you can point to examples of things that aren't necessarily true. And I'm not accepting the premises of the call, but let's just take that as a premise. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't be concerned about false and misleading claims from our own side. That's where we can do the most, make the most difference. That's where we can have the greatest impact. If we tolerate misinformation from our own side less, our politics can be better. It's easy to castigate the other side. It's harder to hold our own side accountable.
Clint, you got 30 seconds. Final thought.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear that call, particularly as you brought up, Marty, the Mueller testimony vis-a-vis the Senate Intel Committee's report, which came out, and there was a Russian agent involved. They declared that, whether that was collusion or whether that was infiltration, unbeknownst to the administration, you could argue that to death. And that's part of the way Russia designs its influence operations. And just last week, Andrei Dukach was designated by the Department of Treasury. He's part of some of these leaked sort of phone calls that are trying to go after Vice President Biden. So it's a persistent threat. We've been overhung on a word called collusion, and then there's a spectrum of activity for influence efforts.
We have to leave it there. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Clint Watts, thanks again.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And Brendan Nyhan, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Always great to be here. Thanks.
Nice to have you both with us. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. And you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us.